Welcome back to Ryan and Brian's Bible Bistro. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Brian.
And this is the Bible Bistro, a podcast all about the Bible, theology, and...
Oh, things...
About the Christian faith. Okay. Anyway, well, welcome back. We're so glad you're with us. We had a great episode last week with talking about... I will never believe Thomas.
Right.
Come on, Thomas. We'll never believe Thomas. And we are recording this on the Saturday before Easter. So,
Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. So we hope by the time you hear this, Easter will have occurred. But we hope that you've had a great Easter and time celebrating, remembering Christ's resurrection.
Hope it's been meaningful for you. And I'm glad you are making us a part of your listening experience.
All right. On that weird note, we're going to continue on into Leviticus.
Yay.
Yes, Leviticus. We're almost done with Leviticus. Yeah, Leviticus. This episode and one more.
Yeah.
And so, but So, Brian, tell us a little bit about where we're going with this.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because my brother David is a longtime listener to our podcast, and we appreciate that. But he sent us an outline of Leviticus that he'd received from a professor several years ago. And here's the only reason I'm going to mention it. This outline suggests that Leviticus could be understood as a chiastic structure. Now, I think we've talked about chiasms before, but if you think about the capital letter key in Greek, it looks like a capital X for us. And a chiastic structure is where you have the beginning of a passage, or in this case, a book, and the end of a book that are parallel. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing in the book and the next to the last thing in the book are parallel. So it's kind of like if you imagine that kind of that shape of that X, it's kind of coming together to a point in the middle. Mm-hmm. And in a chiastic structure, what is at the very center is most important. So in the outline that David sent, which is an interesting one, maybe I don't know if we can put it on our notes or in our comments or not, but here's why I'm mentioning it today is because in that structure, the Day of Atonement was at the very center of the book of Leviticus, and that's what we're beginning with today. Whether Leviticus is chiastic or not, I will say that the Day of Atonement is in some ways the high point of the book. And you know, again, this is kind of the outline. It's a very, it's a very Hebrew approach to an outline because we tend to kind of put the point at the end, you know, the main point at the end. We're building up towards something in a Western way of thinking. But in Hebrew, chiasms are very common, where you have, you know, these parallels kind of stepping in toward the middle, and in the very middle, you have the high point of the book. So the Day of Atonement is what we're going to talk about today. And I thought this is, you know, you're always talking about why are we even talking about Leviticus, and I've suggested it's important for understanding the background. Atonement, you know, we've talked about theories of atonement before. Whenever we talk about atonement in the New Testament, I think it is crucial that we remember that atonement in the New Testament is read against the background of the Old Testament. It's this concept, this idea in the Old Testament that we see in the New Testament, the way that it's used, the way that the idea of atonement is used, which the word atonement or anything similar is very unusual in the New Testament. But this concept is against the Old Testament concept of atonement. That's what we're talking about here, the Day of Atonement. So I thought we'd begin. Read for us the first couple of verses, if you would, of Leviticus 16. Yeah. And Leviticus 16 is really where this Day of Atonement language is found.
Yeah. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, who died when they approached the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell your brother Aaron that he is not to come whenever he chooses into the most holy place, behind the curtain, in front of the atonement ark, in front of the atonement cover on the ark, or else he will die, for I will appear in the cloud over the atonement cover."
So we've talked before about these different commands are sometimes given to Moses and sometimes they're given to Aaron. This is an example of God speaking to Moses, and Moses is then supposed to pass this on to Aaron. We have as a backdrop something we talked about not in the last episode on Leviticus, but a couple of episodes ago, which was the death of the two sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu.
All right.
And so he's bringing this back up again. So it's not following exactly on that, but it's referring back to this death of Nadab and Abihu. And it's because what's being brought up here is how important it is for Aaron to come into the presence of God in an appropriate way. to come into his presence carefully. And that's what this whole thing is about. So famously, you'll know that on the Day of Atonement is the only day that the high priest, and only the high priest, was supposed to enter into the most holy place in the presence of God and to make atonement with God for the sins of, for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people. And so that's what we're going to find here in Leviticus, are the regulations concerning that. Now look at verses 8 through 10. We're going to deal with several chapters today. And by the way, I haven't told you this, Ryan, but there's a lot of material we're going to cover today.
Perfect.
We'll try to get through it quickly and make some sense of it. But read verses 8 through 10. This is the idea of the two goats. So, we'll talk here a little bit more about what Aaron was supposed to sacrifice for himself, but these two goats were part of the sacrifice on behalf of the people.
Yeah, here we go. He is to cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. Aaron shall bring the goat whose lot falls to the Lord and sacrifice it for a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot as a scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to be used for making atonement by sending it into the wilderness as a scapegoat.
Okay, so it's a couple of interesting things here. One of them is one of the most controversial things in Leviticus to talk about. So these two goats were chosen. Just to summarize, basically, one of them was to be offered as a sacrifice for sins. Its blood was to be put on the altar. It was to be put into the most holy place because of the sins of the people of Israel. That was what it did. But the other goat was to be left alive, and it's going to be referred to throughout the rest of this chapter as the goat that's alive. The word there, and this is where we get that word scapegoat, that word scapegoat in Hebrew, so it says one of these goats is for the Lord, and what it says in Hebrew is the other goat is for Azazel. Okay, and that for Azazel is what is translated there as scapegoat. There's different ways of understanding what this other goat was. Now, I'll tell you what happened. In fact, go ahead, just skip down, and we're going to read the instructions about this down in verses 20 through 22. This is the goat, the scapegoat, the one that is left alive.
When Aaron has finished making atonement for the most holy place, the tent of meeting, and the altar, he shall bring forward the live goat. He is to lay both hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the wickedness and rebellion of the Israelites, all their sins, and put them on the goat's head. He shall send the goat away into the wilderness in the care of someone appointed for the task.
Okay, so the whole idea of this is then, so we have the goat that's offered as sacrifice and his blood is placed on the altar the way we have normal sacrifices. This scapegoat, Aaron lays his hands on the head, just like he would on a normal sacrifice, and puts all of the sins of the people, the wickedness of the people, the rebellion of the people on that goat. That's where we get the term scapegoat. You can kind of understand. And then that goat is sent off into the wilderness under the care of somebody. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. But again, that word scapegoat in Hebrew is for Azazel. And that's one of the things that we have to understand here. Now, here there's at least four different ways of understanding this. Let me give you this.
This should help everyone.
Well, some people think this idea, so some people think it's just this idea that the word together means scapegoat. Literally, would have kind of the idea of the goat that is sent away. They think it comes from two different Hebrew words that means the sent away goat, right? So again, this idea of the scapegoat. So that's one way to understand. That's the simplest way to understand it. That might be the way it's understood. Now, the problem is that word Azazel, other places, and particularly in extra-biblical literature, is a word that is used for lack of a better term, a demon. Okay. And so in later, and I'm going to actually read a little bit of, I didn't know whether I was going to do this or not, but I'm going to read a little bit of from First Enoch about this Azazel. And I want you to just listen to this. This is from First Enoch chapter 10, verse 4. And I want you to, Ryan, I want you to think about as I read this, because I don't think I've presented this to you before. I want you to think about what's being described here, how you would describe this Azazel character. So it says, and again, the Lord said to Raphael, and this is in First Enoch again, a book we've talked about before, but it's a later book. It's a Jewish work earlier than the New Testament writings, but is later than the Hebrew Bible. So it's one of those intertestamental pseudepigrapha. It's not really by Enoch, but it's attributed to him. We call it First Enoch. There's all kinds. We've talked about this before. There's all kinds of Enochic literature. Uh-huh. But it says, and again, the Lord said to Raphael, which is one of his messengers, one of his angels, bind Azazel hand and foot and cast him into the darkness and make an opening in the desert, which is in Dudael, and cast him therein and place upon him rough and jagged rocks and cover him with darkness and let him abide there forever and cover his face that he may not see light. And on the day of the great judgment, he shall be cast into the fire and heal the earth, which the angels have corrupted, and proclaim the healing of the earth that they may heal the plague and all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things that the watchers, we'll talk about that another day, have disclosed and have taught their sons, and the whole earth has been corrupted through the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin. So what does that sound like to you?
The Satan, the Satan.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, cast into a pit, covered over, taken away from the light.
Great day of judgment.
Prepared for hell, basically. So if we understand it in this way, what he's basically saying is this one goat is for the Lord, the blood is for the Lord, and the other goat, to put the sins on him, I'll kind of put a colloquial, let their sins go to the devil, right? Go to this evil one. And if we think about in the same way, and again, First Enoch is later than what we're talking about here with the book of Leviticus, but if we think about this kind of idea that Azazel's out there in the wilderness, which is where the goat is sent, that this may be kind of this idea the sins are to be done away with, or they're to be sent to the pit, right?
To the one who is responsible for all of it.
Responsible for all sin, who is the originator of sin.
Give it back to him.
Exactly. And so that's another way to understand. It's pretty interesting, right? Now, the problem is, again, that these references to Azazel are later, and so it could be that this tradition grows out of Leviticus rather than being informed, Leviticus being informed by this kind of an idea. So that's the second way to understand it. The third way to understand it is some people think that Azazel is a place itself. And here's the interesting thing. This is in later rabbinic literature. Again, this is later. So the problem with the scapegoat is the reason they put somebody responsible for it is because you drive a goat out into the wilderness. What do you think it's going to do?
It's going to turn around and come right back.
It's going to come back, right? It knows where home is. It knows where its food is.
Right? It's like a cat. Can't get rid of it.
So they're supposed to take it out into the wilderness and make sure it doesn't return. Okay. Now, they're not to kill it, per se. So it's really interesting. In later rabbinic literature, there's all these traditions about what happens with it. And this is from a later Mishnah Yoma. It's part of the rabbinic, the Talmud, and it talks about some prominent men of Jerusalem used to accompany the goats so far. And basically, they'd have 10 guys that would be stationed out in the wilderness, and they would keep passing this goat on until it got to this place. And then I'll just read this. It says, and he pushed him down. The last guy who's responsible for this goat pushed him down backward, and he went rolling and falling down. He did not reach halfway of the mountain before he became separated from limb to limb, and he returned to sit down in the guy who sent them, the last booth, until dark, and then after dark he could come back into the camp. So basically they think Azazel might be this place, and what they understand it to be a large rocky kind of cliff. They wouldn't kill the goat, but they'd push it down backwards.
Yeah, gravity kills.
Exactly. So it'd fall down. Now, regardless of how we understand this, here's what I want you to see, is that the symbolism is that the sins of the people are being taken away, right? Mm-hmm. They're being—
No matter which scenario you go down.
Exactly. So they are being sent as far away into the wilderness as possible is kind of the idea. They're being taken away from the people outside of the camp. And so that's the important thing. The symbolism here is that we are being separated from our sin. Our sin is being taken away. And again, there's kind of a cool, parallels here. Now, the interesting thing is the scapegoat in that tradition is never mentioned in the New Testament. However, very early, have you ever heard of the Epistle of Barnabas?
I've heard of it, yes, okay. But I haven't read it.
So very early Christian literature began to equate the scapegoat with Jesus. The idea that the sins are placed upon him, he's taken outside of the city of Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. He's done away with, and the sins are then gone, separated, you know, from the people. So that's not in the New Testament at all, but that tradition in early Christianity becomes quite a major deal. So I thought I'd mention that. So I know that's probably more time than the scapegoat deserves, but it's an interesting and it's a controversial part of this whole thing.
Gotcha.
So let's go back into any questions on that before?
I've got all four options, or how many options I got. Yeah. The main point here is no matter what, how that looked, the Day of Atonement was about the sins of the people being cast away.
Yeah, taken away. So read Leviticus 16, 11 through 17. This is the way that Aaron is supposed to operate on the Day of Atonement then.
Aaron shall bring the bull for his own sin offering to make atonement for himself and his household, and he is to slaughter the bull for his own sin offering. He is to take a censer full of burning coals from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of finely ground fragrant incense and take them behind the curtain. He is to put the incense on the fire before the Lord, and the smoke of the incense will conceal the atonement cover above the tablets of the covenant law, so that he will not die. He is to take some of the bull's blood and with his finger sprinkle it on the front of the atonement cover. Then he shall sprinkle some of it with his finger seven times before the atonement cover. He shall then slaughter the goat for the sin offering for the people and take its blood behind the curtain and do with it as he did with the bull's blood. He shall sprinkle it on the atonement cover and in front of it. In this way, he will make an atonement for the most holy place because of the uncleanness and rebellion of the Israelites, whatever their sins have been. He is to do the same for the tent of meeting, which is among them in the midst of their uncleanness. No one is to be in the tent of meeting from the time Aaron goes in to make atonement in the most holy place until he comes out, having made atonement for himself, his household, and the whole community of Israel.
Now, you notice that verb, make atonement, it's repeated several times. I meant to say that ahead of time. The Hebrew word here that's the base for that is kippur, which we're familiar with that word from Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement. If you've heard that, if you've heard maybe the Yom Kippur War, or you've heard references to it. So Yom is the Hebrew word for day, and Kippur simply means atonement. So this is the solemnity in which Aaron was supposed to first make atonement for his own sins, right? The bull was for his own sins. And then the goat was to be offered on behalf of the people, and the blood was sprinkled there. We'll talk a little bit more about blood in just a minute. The other detail there is that before he even goes into the most holy place, and again, this is once a year, only on the Day of Atonement, only the high priest is supposed to go into the Holy of Holies. Before he goes in, he's supposed to put this incense on this censer. So he takes this burning coals and he puts the incense on it. And the idea is that the whole Holy of Holies would be filled with the smoke from that incense, right? And it says, do you notice what it said there in Leviticus? It was to be done so that he would not die, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so the idea is probably, we think it has to do with veiling between him and the presence of God, the holy presence of God. The tradition, again, throughout Scripture is to see God face to face, is to die. Mm-hmm. And so we think that's it. Now, I did come across this interesting quote, and I was reading Gordon Wenham's commentary on Leviticus, and he says that Kyle, have you heard of the Old Testament professor Kyle, the Old Testament writer? Kyle and Delitzsch, they wrote a commentary on the entire Old Testament, pretty famous one back in the day. It's an older one now. But Kyle actually took it the opposite way, that it was to keep the God from viewing sinful humanity, basically. Which I thought was an interesting thought. But mostly we understand this to be the idea that it keeps him from being faced with the presence of God, and therefore it says he will not die. So here's how it was to be done. It's to be done once a year. This is down in verse 29 then. This is after we've talked about the two goats and we've sent the one off into Azazel, wherever that is. And so read 29 through 34 for me, if you will.
Yeah. This is to be a lasting ordinance for you. On the 10th day of the seventh month, month you must deny yourselves and not do any work, whether native-born or foreigner residing among you, because on this day atonement will be made for you, to cleanse you. Then before the Lord you will be clean from all your sins. It is a day of Sabbath rest, and you must deny yourselves. It is a lasting ordinance. The priest who is anointed and ordained to succeed his father as high priest is to make atonement. He is to put on the sacred linen garments and make atonement for the most holy place, for the tent of meeting and the altar, and for the priest and all the members of the community. This is to be a lasting ordinance for you. Atonement is to be made once a year for all the sins of the Israelites, and it was done as the Lord commanded Moses.
So this is you know, talks about what a serious thing this was. Once a year, the sins of all the people were to be forgiven, were to be atoned for on this day. It was to be an ongoing ordinance. It was to be done year after year, is the idea. I've mentioned this before, I think this is the only fast that is mentioned in the entire Jewish calendar. The other regular times of worship were feast days, were days that you would feast, Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Passover. You know, we call them all feast, right? But this was a fast day, and that's what it says a couple of times there. You will deny yourselves. You're not going to eat on this day. You're not going to, you know, indulge in other pleasures on this day. This is a solemn day. It's to be a day of rest. A Sabbath is the idea, and so it's once a year is to be done. Now, the Day of Atonement is mentioned a few times and alluded to, I would say, several times in the New Testament. The biggest example of this is in Hebrews chapter 9, and if you read through Hebrews chapter 9, it almost follows this verbatim. But what the Hebrew writer does, interestingly, is he contrasts the way that the Day of Atonement went with Jesus' sacrifice. You know, you mentioned that we're recording this through the magic of podcast on the weekend of right between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And Jesus' sacrifice, the Hebrew writer contrasts with the Day of Atonement. He does this in at least four ways. He does, first of all, Jesus, the difference, the Hebrew writer says, is he does not need to offer sacrifice for his own sins. The big deal here was made about Aaron has to first offer the bull for his own sins before he can act as the mediator for the people.
Right.
Jesus, as the sinless one, as a sinless priest, is able to simply offer his sacrifice for us. He doesn't need to die for his own sins first, right? He dies for ours. Secondly, and this is what I was talking about, that last thing we read, that this was to be a lasting ordinance. Jesus' sacrifice did not need to be repeated yearly. It was a once-for-all sacrifice that the Hebrew writer says. The third thing, and this is actually, I'll give you the quote. This is Hebrews 9:24. For Christ did not enter a sanctuary made with human hands that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself now to appear for us in God's presence. So that whole idea of the incense and the idea of coming into the presence of God, that was the earthly sanctuary. But Christ enters into the heavenly sanctuary. We've talked before about how the temple was actually a copy of what heaven is, the reality of heaven is. And so Christ's sacrifice is superior in that way as well. And then finally, and this is in chapters 9 and chapter 10 of Hebrews as well, the repeated sacrifices reminded people of the persistence of sin. In other words, they were constantly reminded that sin is—
This is an annual thing.
Always there, right? Mm-hmm. And the sacrifice of Christ reminds us of the permanent forgiveness of sin. And again, all that came out of Wyndham's commentary. I'll give him credit for that. I thought it was a good comparison, though. And when we're talking about the significance of the Day of Atonement for us in New Testament, one of the big things is that there is this contrast between Christ's sacrifice and the sacrifice of the Day of Atonement.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that or anything before we move on?
No, I think it's a good connection to kind of see those two right next to each other. And, you know, this is, yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, but that Leviticus is setting things up that are taking, we understand what Christ is accomplishing as we look back through Leviticus and what's happening there.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to summarize 17 pretty quickly because we're going to try to get through chapter 22 of Leviticus today, if that works. So Leviticus chapter 17, there's a couple things that are said. The first is in verses 8 and 9, sacrifices are only to be made in the tabernacle. You got to remember, this is still, they're still in the wilderness during this period of time. Later in the temple would be the same thing. And the idea here is that each person was not supposed to have their own place of, their own altar, right? Their own place of worship. And later this becomes an issue for the Israelites. You remember when they went into Canaan, that was one of the criticisms. There's an altar under every spreading tree and under every high place, or on every high place. Right. You're worshiping in all these different places. But the idea that the tabernacle and then later the temple, it was to be a central place of worship that you came. And it was to bring unity to God's people. It was to, you know, cause them to recognize that this was the legitimate place. And it became a problem for them because everybody was kind of doing their own thing. You might remember we had, when we talked about the book of Judges, we had Dr. Michelle Knight on here to talk about Judges. And we get to the end of the book of Judges, and you've got this rogue priest out, you know, acting as a priest out on an altar out of way. And that's a symbol of this, or not a symbol, this is a story that kind of tells the opposite of what the book of Leviticus calls for.
Yeah, I think she made some comment like, how you know the story's off to a bad start is when you've got a wandering priest.
Right, who's not doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Not supposed to be doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Right, so here's the other one. This is chapter 17. Just read verses 10 through 12. I found this interesting as well. Yeah.
I will set my face against any Israelite or any foreigner residing among them who eats blood. I will cut them off from the people. For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Therefore I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may any foreigner residing among you eat blood.
So this is a pretty famous passage. It actually goes on a few verses after this. I had you just read the highlights, but it goes on and talks about don't eat blood. It's a major, major part of what's going on here. And I want you to notice, I think it's interesting that it's for religious reasons. You know, the blood is for the sacrifice, is the idea. The blood is being offered for sacrifice. But I find this interesting in Acts chapter 15. Do you remember the Jerusalem Council?
Yeah,
in Acts chapter 15. They're talking about what do Gentiles need to do. The kind of the early Christian Jewish leaders, the apostles and the early leaders are trying to decide, how can Gentiles come to Christ? Like, what do they need to fulfill? Mm-hmm. And there was a decision, you know, well, they didn't need to be circumcised and other things. But there were four things. There are only four things they said, well, the Gentiles should you know, observe these things. You remember what four they were?
Well,
I always forget one.
But. Yeah, well, so one of them is they don't need to be circumcised.
Right, but these there are four things that they do need to keep in the law, so to speak. One of them is food sacrifice to idols. They're not to eat meat sacrifice to idols. Now, later on, Paul talks about, well, it depends on conscience is what he says in regard to meat sacrifice to idols.
Mm-hmm.
The second is meat that's been strangled.
Yes.
And the third is blood. And the fourth is sexual immorality.
Yes.
I didn't give them in correct order, but those are the four things. And I find it interesting that blood is one of those things that's mentioned. And I guess I say this to say it shows how central this was to the Jewish way of thinking. And that's why even today, you know, there's a Jewish butcher first, right? Mm-hmm. Any community of Jews needs to have a shop that's going to, or a butcher that's going to correctly deal with the meat in a way that's going to be in keeping with their regulations. You know, the body is to be drained of blood before it's eaten. And so that's the, you know, the big thing here. And it's for a religious reason. Now, well, I don't know if we want to talk about this or not, but, you know, part of Christ's sacrifice being once for all, I think, well, and we have the scripture that talks about, Jesus declared all things clean. It's not what goes into my mouth, it's what comes out of it that makes a person unclean. And the narrator at that point then says, well, by this, Jesus declared all foods clean. But it is interesting to me that this was a concern of the early Jewish Christians that this is one of the things that shouldn't be done.
And you know, Paul, I mean, it's a common conversation that Paul has with people, you know, Galatians, Romans, like this is a common conversation that comes up about how, especially as we're being blending the two peoples together to make a new people.
Big deal in the early church for sure. So Yeah. Any other questions? So that's basically 17. That's my summary of 17. Not a lot going on there.
No, good.
Chapter 18, verses 1 through 5. I'll go ahead and read this. This is giving us, I've talked about this before, this is giving us the historical context, really, for all of these laws. The Lord said to Moses, and so here again, the Moses is the one being addressed, speak to the Israelites and say to them, I am Yahweh your God, or the Lord your God. You must not do as they do in Egypt, where you used to live. Okay, so don't do the things like they did there. And you must not do as they do in the land of Canaan, where I'm bringing you. So this reminds us, Leviticus is given to us in the wilderness context. Mm-hmm. They've left Egypt. They've not yet entered the promised land. But God says that there's prohibitions against both the way that the Egyptians lived and also the way the Canaanites lived, that you are to be, we've talked about this before, a holy, a set apart, a separate kind of people. Mm-hmm. You must not do as they do in the land of Canaan, where I'm bringing you. Do not follow their practices. You must obey my laws and be careful to follow my decrees. I am Yahweh your God. Keep my decrees and laws, for the person who obeys them will live by them. I am Yahweh. So this is kind of, again, the, you know, I would say this applies to the entire book of Leviticus, but here he's getting ready to get into some of the very specific language of prohibition. And part of it is, don't live like the pagans, right? Don't live like mm-hmm. like these other groups do, which, you know, that concept is still carried on into the New Testament as well. So there's a couple of controversial things in this chapter as well. This is one of those chapters that you see brought up on social media from time to time.
The old TikTok.
So we'll talk about that a little bit. The first section here is a major section on matters of sexuality, and I'm not going to go through in detail, but there are a couple of things we learn from this. You know, he basically says incest, you don't do that. It's mm-hmm. not a good thing. But it's interesting because he counts as incest not only those who are your blood relatives, but also your relatives by marriage, mm-hmm. Brothers and sisters. You know, he mentions that, and you know, that there's a way in which you know this is not an appropriate action. This carries on to the New Testament. You might remember in 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about you know, the pagans there, you're doing as they do. You know, there's a man in your church who has his father's wife, which is a prohibition here clearly in Leviticus. And Paul says there that, you know, that's the way the pagans do. And you should not do that. You're proud of it and you shouldn't do it. So matters of sexuality here are what's in view. Now, he gives the reason for this again down in chapter 18, verses 24 through 28. Do you want to go ahead and read that for me?
Yeah,
24 to 28.
No problem. Do not defy yourselves in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sins, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native-born and the foreigners residing among you must not do any of these detestable things, for all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you.
So again, he's contrasting the practices of the Canaanites, the people that are in the land now, with what the people of God are supposed to do, what the people of Israel are supposed to do here in this. So matters of sexuality, he mentions adultery. This is in verse 18. He mentions, you know, basically any kind of an adulterous relationship. He mentions child sacrifice is prohibited. This is 18:21. And what he specifically says is you're not to offer your child a sacrifice to Moloch. Mm-hmm. Now, Moloch is mentioned several times in Scripture. Actually, he's even mentioned in the New Testament, the book of Acts, a quotation from the Old Testament. But Moloch worship became a problem for the Israelites, again, because they didn't drive out the Canaanites. I wasn't planning on doing this. Go ahead and I'll actually find it. 1 Kings chapter 11, this became a major issue for Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 11, I think it is. Is that what I have there? Verses 5 through 7. So you might remember at the end of his life, Solomon had all these wives. I don't know if you remember that part of the story or not. And it says at the end of his life, they turned his heart away from God. And this is part of the description of that is in chapter 11. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Ashtoreth is Asherah, and it's Baal's consort. I think we've talked about that before.
Asherah poles and so forth.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because here's the issue is part of the worship of these gods had a sexual element to it. And he's basically saying you're not to be doing things in this way. Temple prostitutes, right? There's prohibition against giving your children to be temple prostitutes. And it's part of that whole idea that this is the way that the pagans worship, and you're not to participate in it in this way. So he followed Asherah, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David, his father, had done. And I always find this an interesting statement. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives. So again, Moloch is mentioned here. Moloch is mentioned later in the book of 1 Kings, problem for other kings. So here specifically, God says to his people, you're not to offer your children to Moloch in sacrifice. And again, it gives us a sense of God's standards, moral standards, is standard of holiness for his people, is a part of what's going on here. Now, the controversial thing, I don't want to stay away from this, is the statement about homosexuality in Leviticus 18:22. You should not lie with a man in the same way that you lie with a woman. This is detestable, right? And this has become very controversial. Here's where, how do you see this in social media? What's your,
It was about prostitution. Or okay. It could be about pagan.
Sure.
It was just about paganness. And also, you know, this is the Old Testament. We have the New Testament.
Right.
You know, Jesus didn't say this. Right. So we just toss this at the side.
I see this a lot that, you know, people will say, oh, well, the same chapter and you know, the same part of Leviticus, they quote this, then it says you shouldn't cut your beard either, you know. And so you know, there's this this kind of an idea of trying to diminish what's being said here. I want you to notice this is in this context of prohibitions against sexuality, though, which, again, in Acts 15 was one of the things that they specifically said sexual immorality was supposed to be held up. I think there's a couple things here. God's people's relationship with God is often depicted as a marriage, right? We are the bride of Christ in the New Testament. God's people are presented as his bride. And the language of idolatry often carries this language of sexual adultery. Infidelity, right? Yeah. But the other part of it is this, is homosexuality it's not only here, but it is mentioned several times in Scripture, Book of Deuteronomy. In the New Testament, it's mentioned in Romans chapter 1. The Apostle Paul mentions it in other books. It's mentioned in every place, including the book of Revelation. In all those places, it's condemned, right? This is a consistent within the Judeo-Christian text. It is consistently this. Now, there are other things, and I don't want to get too much into this today. Mm-hmm. It actually made me think, I don't know whether we should do this or not. Well, we should do it, whether or not we will, but we probably should do an episode on this because it's such a major issue today. But what I will say today is that, you know, from here, it's not just this passage in Leviticus. The consistent witness of Scripture is that homosexuality is something that is condemned, is something that's not to be practiced. And sexual morality as a whole, right? God gave us sexuality for a reason. And it has to do with the intimacy of the marriage relationship. And there's a number of different ways in which we mess that up, and we can mess that up, right? But it's we are created as sexual beings. And it's something that God has put parameters and boundaries on that we have to be careful about, I think, in the way that we approach. So any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is it's an important topic, and it's obviously one that still brings a lot of attention that everyone comes to. You know, there's a documentary recently that said, like, oh, the word homosexuality wasn't inserted in the Bible until the, the mid-1900s. And it's like, well, yeah, because the concept was there, but, you know, that word had just become part of the vocabulary of an... I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, it's... We get in these conversations, well, Jesus didn't say something specifically, and it's like, but Jesus is a Jew, and Jesus would, you know, like, this is, if we look at this as one continued story, and not something that gets broken up into to chunks, that we see that this is, there are some very specific things that are carried through into the New Testament, and that we need to be careful about how we look at those things.
I think that's correct, and yeah, we'll, again, we'll probably say more about this later on in clear ways.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Leviticus 19 then, as we move on. And you're going to really like the way I deal with these last two chapters. It's we've been slow rolling, but I'm going to speed it up here in a minute.
Love it.
Go ahead and read verses 1 and 2 of Leviticus 19 for me.
The Lord said to Moses. Moses had a lot to listen to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we mentioned, you know, he several times, more than any, he speaks to Moses. And then Moses is the one who's supposed to speak to the people. Or to Aaron, you know, whoever's supposed to receive this message.
The Lord said to Moses, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. That's it. That's
okay,
1 through 2.
Yeah, so he says this idea of the holiness is on this whole section is going to deal with social issues of holiness. So how do you treat your neighbor? How do you treat other kinds of people? Down in verses 9 and 10, he talks about generosity. This is an example. Basically, we don't have to read it. I'll tell you. He says, when you harvest your fields, don't harvest the corners. Don't go all the way to the edge. Don't try to cut the corner close. And here, and we've talked about this before, really what we need to look at are what are these principles that are being taught. And it's the idea of instead of trying to accumulate as much wealth as possible yourself, make sure you're also being generous toward those who are in need. So rather than, quote unquote, maximizing your profits, right, by gleaning to the very corner of the fields, then leave some for those who can go out and glean for themselves in order to provide for themselves, for the poor in the land. He mentioned specifically foreigners. If we read down then what follows this, I mean, I'm just going to summarize. He says, don't lie to one another. Don't pervert justice. Don't cheat your neighbor. Don't try to defraud your neighbor. Don't speak ill against your neighbor. All these have to do with social kind of commands. You know, again, New Testament, do good to one another, right? Be generous to one another. These are the kind of commands that are given. Read verses 17 and 18 for me. This is 19, 17 through 18, which is, I find this interesting.
Yeah. Do not hate a fellow Israelite in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so you will not share in their guilt. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord.
Does that sound familiar to you?
It does.
This is where Jesus quotes the book of Leviticus, love your neighbor as yourself. What are the greatest commands is what he asks. And, and what is the greatest command? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And he quotes Leviticus here, love your neighbor as yourself. In the midst of these social instructions about how to treat one another. Down in verses 32 through 37, I find this grouping interesting. So he says, stand up in the presence of the aged. So basically show respect to those who are older, right? Don't just treat them like they're nothing. Show respect for the elderly and revere your God. I am the Lord. When a foreigner, this is one that we've seen quoted a lot recently. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So don't forget where you came from and treat others with that same kind of respect. All this, you know, so perverting justice and generosity and all this has to do with those who are in a position where they don't have the power, right? Mm-hmm. And he's saying that we need to treat them differently. And of course, Christ modeled this. I think about the parable of the Good Samaritan, for example,
right,
where he says, who's really his brother, right? Who really was his neighbor? And he's the one who followed the law, basically, even though he was a Samaritan. And also Jesus' own example. We celebrated Maundy Thursday a couple of days ago, and one of the constant reminders there is that Jesus, though he could have used his authority for his own purposes, right, instead took on the form of a servant, Philippians chapter 2, and also we see the example in John chapter 13, took on the form of a servant and washed his disciples' feet. And then he says to his disciples, do you see what I've done for you? You should do the same for one another. I think it's important, not just, although, foot washing, we practice hand washing now, mm-hmm. is a good reminder, but the importance is the way that we serve one another in our everyday lives, not just on Maundy Thursday, right? It's not just that practice, but it is the way that we pour ourselves out on behalf of others. And then he goes on here, says, do not use dishonest standards when measuring length, weight, or quantity. Again, you think the principle here is instead of trying to accumulate wealth for yourself, be fair with people, right? Don't try to accumulate too much. Use honest scales and honest weights, an honest ephah, measuring of grain, and an honest hin. I am the Lord, that's a measuring of liquid. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. And then here's the summary. Keep all my decrees and all my laws and follow them. I am the Lord. Thoughts on that? Any questions or comments on that?
I don't think so. I mean, it's as much as that there's in there, there's probably a lot of stuff that there's scenarios that are not in there, which,
sure,
you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but it's just kind of, it's setting up guiding principles. And mm-hmm. that are to be carried out.
Yeah. And I think we see something about God's heart. You know, don't take advantage of those who are powerless. Don't misuse your own strength to just gain wealth for yourself. Care for one another, have respect for other people. It's those kind of principles, I think, that we see at work here. The best example of Christianity, I think, is where we see following the model of Jesus, right? We see ourselves not trying to gain advantage through power, but instead we recognize that in the act of ministering to and serving one another. You know, I think about our discussion with Andrew Root. You know, that's what we have as the church that is countercultural, right? Is against the way that we see our culture often speaking and acting. So we need to be discipled by Scripture, I think. Leviticus 20 starts with Moloch again. We have all this stuff about Moloch. And here's how I will summarize chapter 20. Really, there's nothing new in 19. We have a repetition of the sexual, incest and these kind of things. What chapter 20 does is it lays out the severity of the punishments. In other words, it's trying to say, this is how important this stuff is. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we can't allow sin to fester within the community. It needs to be dealt with. It needs to be done away with, or else it will become a bigger issue. Verses 6 and 7 then, this is Leviticus chapter 20, verses 6 and 7, says, I will set my face against anyone who turns to mediums and spiritists to prostitute themselves. There's that language, sexual language for a spiritual or religious reality. Who turns to mediums or spiritists to prostitute themselves by following them, I will cut them off from their people. And then he says this, consecrate yourselves. We saw that repeatedly in the first part of the book of Leviticus. Consecrate yourselves and be holy because I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and follow them. I am the Lord who makes you holy. So again, this idea of being set apart, modeling the heart of God and his holiness, not that we can attain his holiness, but we want to reflect his holiness in our lives. So that's chapter 20. Mostly it's about the severity of the punishments that are to be meted out.
The first part of it is about Moloch and the pretty severe punishments there.
That's death. I mean, to be, and that seems, seems harsh. But again, I think it has to do with, in the same way that God commands his people to drive out the Canaanites, because otherwise these things will be a temptation for you. I think in the same way, the Israelites who are practicing these things need to be done away with because their sin, will affect others. We see it especially in the book of, we could go to Judges again, or I mentioned 1 Kings and Solomon earlier. Mm-hmm. Ahab and Jezebel, you know, when they are, right, when they are the ones who are in power, Baal worship becomes the state religion, you know, for lack of a better term. And Elijah thinks, I'm the only worshiper of the true God left. Now, you know, God...
We have a showdown.
Yeah, God disabuses him of that notion. So, no, there's a thousand that haven't bowed their knee. But it's the pressure of the state in the same way. I guess we could say it this way. In the same way that our society, we feel the pressures of the underlying beliefs of our own society that run counter to the nature of our following Jesus. We can see a similar kind of thing in the Old Testament. And I think that's why these punishments are severe.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to think about, I had a conversation with someone once about Solomon, and he has all this wisdom literature, the wisdom of Solomon. And I'm like, it's always interesting to read, for me, Proverbs, knowing what becomes of Solomon. And he's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, Solomon... goes down, you know, it's easy for us to read the story of Solomon and think like, oh, he's the wisest and he did all this stuff and all things were good. But like he himself was seduced by this. And Moloch, you know, Solomon had the most wisdom, you know, he's like exalted for his wisdom. But he still found himself in this place. And thinking about Moloch and the punishment of sacrifice to Moloch here. And then you think about Solomon and you're like, yeah.
I think it's happening there. It's interesting you say that because you know the scriptures say that it's his wives that led him astray. Yeah. In other words, he had these relationships,
foreign wives.
Many of them were outlandish women. That's the King James, from outside the land, outlandish. Yeah. Some of them were political marriages, certainly. You know, but for whatever, he allowed his love for his wives to turn his heart away from God, and I think that. You know, that points out to several things. I should have mentioned polygamy is expressly forbidden. And when we talked about that sexual, that section on sexual immorality back in Leviticus 18, what we understand, let me see if I can find that verse. I think it's, is it 18? It talks about... one thing it says, do not have sexual relations with your brother's wife. That would dishonor your brother. Levirate marriage is obviously an exception to that. Oh, verse 18, do not take your wife's sister as a rival wife and have sexual relations with her while your wife is living. Some people think this is the idea of a polygamy, not just her blood sister, right? But also her sister Israelite. You're not to have rival wives is the idea. And people will talk about, well, the Old Testament, you've got, in fact, I saw another one of those funny social media, not funny, but social media memes the other day about, well, when I talk about biblical marriage, polygamy is not outside the question, right?
Right.
Again, the scriptures are clear in their testimony that that was not God's desire. That was not the way it was supposed to be. And we see all the problems that happened, even in, you know, we mentioned Solomon, even in David's life, there were issues that came about as a result of that. Even you can go back to Jacob. And you can see the problems between Leah and Rachel. You can even go back to Abraham, and you can see the problems between Hagar and Sarah, which that you know technically it wasn't a marriage there, but the rivalry between those two mothers of his children that we have going on with Abraham. So it's not God's ideal, and even here in the law, there seems to be this indication you're not to do this kind of thing. Jacob marrying Leah and Rachel is in direct contradiction. Quote unquote conservatively or narrowly we define Leviticus 18:18,
it's wrong any way you slice the pie.
Right? He messed up one way or the other. You know, and we see the results of that that caused trial caused issues within his family. So anyway, again, we see these things. Let me finish up here, and then I'll see if there's any final things. Leviticus chapters 21 and 22, I'll simply say, is a lot of repetition here, but holding priests to a higher standard. And the way I always say it is exemplary behavior. In other words, they are held to a higher standard, but they are also to be an example for the people. So where the religious leaders are leading the people correctly, they should be showing by example, adhering to God's law. And that's, you know, that's what they're called to in chapters 21, 22. There are some specific issues where there are places where a quote-unquote average Israelite, non-priestly Israelite, could marry a woman. But for a priest, that would be off limits. And so we see some examples of that, just exemplary behavior that's called for from the priesthood, as we've discussed before, when we looked at Nadab and Abihu and those kind of things. So,
it's a lot.
Yeah, this is a big section.
Again, as we've kind of gone through this again, is understanding that some of this is culturally situated, but the parts of it.
I would say all of it is culturally situated. You know, that's the thing, right? I'm always saying is all of Scripture is culturally situated, but the principles are all universal. Mm. You know, what God is saying to us through, you know, what he was saying to his people then, if we understand the reasons, then we can apply it to our situation, I think, directly. So,
yeah. Anyway, so as we read Leviticus, that there's good things in there, but we, you know, how we read it and think about it and interpret it for today is important as well.
I think that's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So,
all right, Brian. Well, thanks so much, guys. Yeah. Hold on. We appreciate you listening. We're almost done with Leviticus. But I know I've made jokes about this every week, but this is good for us to go through to understand this, especially as we just came out of Easter and now we're talking about atonement and what's going on in there. That there's some very direct connections that we can understand. New Testament concepts, we need to understand how they unfolded in the Old Testament as well to really get a full picture of them. So, Brian, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. I
appreciate your time, and we'll be back next Tuesday. If you'd like, you can go to our website, thebiblebistro.com. You can find links there. If you want to, we have the bookstore on there. Just a reminder, if you're interested in any books or anything that Brian and I recommend or are reading, you can go in there and find that, or you can find our other past episodes. Like and share, and if you're feeling so inclined, you know, you can join us on Patreon and support the Bistro for software like this that we're doing this like right here. We're going to be traveling together here a little bit, spending some time together, and also pulling in some more guests. So any way that you can support us would be great. We really appreciate it. And Brian,
any recommendations or suggestions you got, make sure to let us know. We're always open to hearing what you
can sign up for a newsletter there. That's something is coming out. I've been working on that. And also you can shoot us a message from there as well. So
hope you have had by the time you listen, have had a blessed Easter, and look forward to next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Brian.
Bye.
Bye.